From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 17 for Friday, the 18th of March, 2011. On the show this week is this. You'd be forgiven for thinking that noise was the sound of Justin Bieber shouting for help from under a bus, but it was in fact the sound of a piece of food being eaten with a new invention from a Japanese university. You'll find out what a little later after we explore the Week in Wired News. Hello there, I am Nate Langson and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me in the singularity of Wired's pet black hole is senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
Hello there.
And Olivia underscore Solon.
Hi.
You're back from Ireland visiting Intel, I hear.
I am indeed.
I don't just hear it, I actually knew that.
Okay, great.
I'm all knowing. How are we doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty good. How are you?
I'm cooking with gas. And first on
have
my...
Have you watched your carbon footprint?
No. No, I actually haven't. I really don't know what my carbon footprint
is. Have you washed your feet?
Have I washed my feet?
Your cheese feet.
For the benefit of the listeners, I've actually taken my shoes off. Liv's just being rude.
That really doesn't benefit listeners. Or us. In fact, I don't know who it benefits.
No.
Maybe you.
Maybe.
I'm not sure.
Well, I feel a lot better now that my shoes are off. And
well,
I'm sure everyone else does too.
We should all be feeling better about the threat of space junk, because NASA is considering shooting down bits of space junk with medium-powered lasers. At any given time, the US military monitors about 20,000 pieces of junk in low Earth orbit. And the real problem there is that, obviously, the more there is, the more it's likely to collide with... new launches and spacecraft and satellites and things like that.
Yeah.
And so a lot of this debris is actually produced when larger bits of, old spacecraft and things collides into each other and creates more small bits, which obviously increases the potential threat of an impact, which can be quite damaging. And what this proposition is, which was submitted to Advances in Space Research and was on archive.org, is that if you get these lasers to sort of basically shoot one piece away from another piece, then you're avoiding a collision. So you're not essentially destroying the junk, but you're just making it less dangerous. Is that right?
So, yeah, I think so. How does it exactly work? I mean, they shoot a big laser into the sky, but what does that actually do?
Where are the lasers?
So these lasers are based on the ground, and they are shone through telescopes. And lasers are made up of photons, obviously, as part of the light. And every photon has a tiny amount of momentum in it. So the idea is that if they shine these lasers on small bits of debris in low Earth orbit for about an hour or two every day, then they can move the entire object by about 200 meters a day, which could be enough to avoid about half of all space collisions.
So I guess debris. Is it just about kind of like nudging the objects out of the way then, basically?
Pretty much, yeah.
Rather than sort of blowing them into smithereens.
Yeah, that's right. And the lasers are actually commercially available lasers that they cost about half a million pounds, and are actually used, or similar ones are used for welding and like cutting metal in car factories, things like that. And earlier plans did rely for similar systems relied on military class lasers that would potentially destroy objects altogether or vaporize part of it.
And is it about moving space objects away from satellites and the like, or is it about moving them away from each other so they don't become smaller?
Exactly, it's about moving them away from each other. The more objects there are up there, then the more chance there is of something potentially colliding or things like that. So. Interesting. One to follow for sure. But in other space news, in fact, we've got quite a space-heavy first section of the show here. BAE Systems has thrown its weight behind a new radio telescope that could be 50 times more sensitive than any similar observatory built to date. Duncan, this excites me greatly.
Good. I'm pleased to hear it. It excites me too. This is an array called the Square Kilometre Array, which doesn't actually exist yet. It's due to be built in the latter part of this decade, and the first observations won't arrive till 2019, and the full operation won't start till 2024. But what it is it's a network of loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of little radio telescopes dotted across a country. It looks like it's either going to be Australia or South Africa, because there's much, much less radio interference in the southern hemisphere. And these satellites will be stretched practically across the width of the entire continent so that they can get so much more detail and a much, much greater resolution.
But the problem there is that the telescopes have to communicate with each other, because you're collecting all the data from individual telescopes, combining it to give you one image, and that's going to take pretty much, what is it, more bandwidth than we actually have on Earth, or something similar.
It's kind of, they're going to need long-haul links between different sort of central points that have a capacity that's greater than the current global internet traffic right now. And that's not really a problem quite yet, because they're not even going to start building it until 2016. But that's where BAE has got involved, because they want to be in on the systems and the software that is able to deal with the data, that kind of capacity data, and also the computer engines that will be able to sift through it and analyze it and process it.
You know, this reminds me a lot of the Large Hadron Collider project. I mean, this is going to cost something like a billion pounds, I think, to put together.
1.3 billion, and there's about 20 different countries involved in the construction process.
Yeah, and it's multinational projects as well, so lots of countries involved, which is the way we like things to be.
But what it will do is it'll give us much, much clearer images of some really, really interesting objects in the universe. Pulsars and nebulae and quasars and remnants of supernovas all give out large amounts of electromagnetic radiation in radio frequencies. And it's these objects that we study more through radio frequencies than we do through your traditional optical telescope, like the kind of one that you might have in your back garden.
Mm. Well, this isn't going to start making any kind of observation until 2019. And even then, it's not going to be running at full capacity, because that's not going to be till 2024. So it's actually quite a massively ambitious project that's going to take a significant amount of time before we start seeing any results from it.
We're away, yeah. But BAE having contributed a huge whack of money towards it should definitely help matters.
How does this compare to anything else that we've got at the moment?
It's rather bigger. I mean, it's called the Square Kilometre Array, and that's the reason for that is because the collecting area across all of the dishes represents a square kilometre. We already have the Very Large Array, I think, is it?
Yeah, in New Mexico. And that's the one people may have seen in that film, Contact.
Yeah, and this is going to be larger still, so it'll let us sort of survey the sky much quicker and at a much greater resolution than existing telescopes.
Well, in our final bit of space news, Liv, tell me about this Fireball Network you wrote about.
Yeah, well, it's this amazingly named, the Fireball Network, as you said. It's NASA has built this meteor tracking network of cameras that are facing up towards the sky across the US. And what they're doing is they're tracking all meteors that come in to the Earth's atmosphere, and anything that is brighter than Venus. So, and that's what a fireball is. It's a meteor that burns brighter than Venus. And what these cameras do, it's fully automated, and they record every single one of these meteors. And then all the videos and all the data is uploaded to this central website, which anyone can access. And so if you've seen something in the night skies, provided you're in the US, you can go back to that night, go to the data and check it out again, watch it on rewind and replay.
So there are only three cameras at the moment, but they're going to roll it out to 15 cameras in the eastern half of the US, and they're talking to schools and planetariums and science centers, places like that. And it's not really going to be a warning system, though, is it? It's more likely that it's too late once you've seen something.
Yeah, it's not really about warning. It's more about looking at the trajectory of the meteors and to find out where they might have come from, potentially if they where they might land, so you can gather together, get some space rock to examine, and also try and work out ways to protect spacecraft from meteor. I'm going to say attacks, but it's not attacks. From
damage, I guess.
Meteor damage, precisely.
Well, there's a great video that we've got a link to from the story on the website. If you search for Fireball Network, there's a link to a video. And when I first saw this video that Duncan was showing me, I thought he was showing me a video of NASA having spotted a dragon. But actually what it turned out is that there was a spider walking across the camera lens, which I think is possibly the most amusing use for a meteor tracking camera.
It identified it as an object, but I don't think they classified that one.
They didn't. Well, we're going to move on from space now. That's all the space news finished. In the intro, we played something that sounded like Justin Bieber squealing, but it was actually, it was this. Let's refresh ourselves. Yeah, and what this is the sound of an e-theremin, which is a theremin device, which is a kind of musical instrument that musicians play without actually having to touch a keyboard or anything like that. It sort of detects the position of your hands, and you affect the kind of creepy electric frequency sound by moving your hands you know, towards and away from it.
A bit like in the Doctor Who theme tune.
Exactly, yeah. People like Jean-Michel Jarre use this, use it a lot. And what this is a theremin that relies on the conductivity and the density of food. And you're hearing someone here actually eat a piece of chicken. Our very brand new shiny intern, Alice, who's actually in the room. Shout hello, Alice. Wrote this story, and it's kind of a weird video to watch because it is basically people eating pieces of food that are kind of squealing.
It's always really creepy watching videos of people eating food. Have you ever found that?
It really is. Yeah, absolutely.
It's and like that bit in the middle of Jurassic Park where they're in the kitchen, they found that feast. It's just really horribly creepy. If you watch it again, you'll see what I mean.
Well, these are food utensils, and they look like forks. They are forks called e-teremin. Eat. Theremin, which I think is where the name probably comes from. Quite obvious that. And it creates an electrical circuit when it comes into contact with human body moisture. It does actually mean that it works on skin and things like that, but apparently is much better. The wetter, the better. So the mouth is the optimal place for you to be shoving this. So it's a bit of a fun project here, and you know, I'm not sure if they're actually going to start selling these devices, but the idea is that you could create a kind of mini food orchestra, as Alice put in the story, during lunchtime, which is probably quite fun for kids.
I think, yeah, the idea is to make eating a bit more fun.
Yeah, definitely. I would absolutely do this. I mean, I only eat about three different things, but yeah. If I can make music while I'm doing it, imagine how hilarious
that would
be.
You'll make three notes. It'll be really dull.
For most people, eating's fun enough as it is already.
Duncan, kind of make a sort of food punk band.
Could you imagine how much fun your cheese club would be if it made a sound like this?
Cheese Guild.
Yeah, we're calling it a guild
now.
We
renamed it the Cheese Guild today.
It was pompous enough as a cheese club, and now you're calling it a guild.
Yeah, we don't want to talk about it with you because you'll not remember.
I'm not. It's because I only eat Cathedral City.
Yeah.
I should point out many other cheeses are available. Let's move on from e-teremins and eating, and let's talk about Apple, which...
you can eat an apple.
Ah, touche. Another good catch. Apple has come under a little bit of criticism after it released the new iOS 4.3 operating system for iPhones and iPod Touch and the iPad. And apparently the web browser that, if you're browsing the web normally, is significantly faster because of a new JavaScript engine called Nitro, which basically lets you process web apps that you browse to much, much quickly, much more quickly, rather. But in web apps, in applications that basically use part of the web browser technology, it's not getting to take advantage of that Nitro engine. And so web apps are basically not getting the speed boost. And
yeah,
Duncan,
it's pretty easy to sort of check this for yourself if you've got an iPhone handy. What you need to do is open up a kind of JavaScript speed test page in Mobile Safari, run it, write down the results, and then save the web page to the home screen as an icon, and then open it up from there and run the test, and you'll get a massive, massive difference in the speed results you get back.
And the real criticism here is because there is some sort of conspiracy theory that Apple is doing this to encourage people to use native apps that you can buy through the iTunes store instead of making web apps.
Yeah, I mean, with anything Apple, there's always going to be murmurings about them, you know, doing stuff to screw over the consumer, but to help their market share. But to be honest, I think this is probably a bit of a stretch. I think it's probably just a bug that they haven't implemented it widely.
It's probably just something that's going to get fixed down the line, but some people are kind of concerned about this.
And yeah, I mean, what we'll need to see basically is in the next iOS patches whether it gets fixed. And if it does, which I'm sure it probably will, then yeah, it was just a bug. And if not, then maybe something more sinister is going on.
This would be a great point for you to go on the Android pedestal, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
Are you going to?
No.
Fair enough. Well, if you've had any, if you've noticed any problems, do let us know, because it'd be really interesting to see how widely this is affecting people, if at all. I suspect it's not affecting people that much, but drop us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk. If you have any thoughts, Duncan, do you remember that product you bought once that was brown and no one else bought it except for you and you could squirt on it?
That's a bit mean. Liv had one as well.
Yeah,
no,
I got given it by Microsoft. We are, of course, talking about the troubled MP3 player that is known as the Zune. According to Bloomberg, Microsoft is axing the MP3 player to focus on other ventures like Windows Phone 7. Zune obviously launched in the US in 2006, and they made promises after promises that it was going to launch over in Europe, and they delayed it and delayed it and delayed it until finally Steve Ballmer announced in 2010, last year in October, that they weren't going to bring the device to Europe because, again, they wanted to focus on Windows 7. However, Windows has come back and said, Microsoft rather, has come back and said, we're not technically getting rid of it. The platform, the software that we're it used is going to live on within Windows 7 and online.
Specifically, it's within Windows Phone 7.
Windows Phone 7,
that this year's hardware for Zune is Windows Phone 7.
Which is a bit silly because that's software.
Yeah,
it
and
is,
the
but
software
you can see what they're
rubbish
at.
Anyway.
You can see what they're getting at. And the Zune experience on Windows Phone 7 is pretty much the same as the Zune HD, which was the good Zune.
Yeah, I mean, what it seems to be is that they're transitioning the whole Zune brand more and more away from dedicated devices, because people don't really buy dedicated MP3 players very much these days, because phones are good enough to do it for you. And so what they're doing is moving it over onto the software side, because the Zune team has always had good design in terms of that. Generally, the actual software that you used to load tracks on was always a bit horrible, but generally it was pretty nice and it looked good. And so I think it's just a case of them moving over in that direction. And probably what's happened here is that Bloomberg has heard that there wasn't going to be any more physical stuff in the near future, and they're just you know, misreporting that as Zune is dead, when it's been a long demise, slow.
It's a bit of a case of the Zune is dead, long live the Zune.
Yeah. Well, it's actually probably going to be long live the Zune for quite a while, because a chap from the Zune team, Dave McLaughlin, who is the head of business development for the Zune platform, said that Zune actually isn't going anywhere and they're still working on Zune hardware business development, but there's just not going to be any new hardware this year. So yeah, I call shenanigans.
Believe it when I see it.
Yeah, I call shenanigans. I think that it's kind of a bit of a defensive move, but that he didn't say there is going to be new hardware. He's just saying there isn't necessarily not going to be any new hardware. I think it's kind of a shame that the Zune HD never came to the UK, because it was actually a really nice piece of kit.
I mean, the big problem was it never had apps, and the apps were... It sort of came out at a point where everyone was getting very, very, very excited about apps.
Well, it came out long after the iPod Touch, and after the iPod Touch really took over as being kind of not just a music player, but a proper media player and browser and obviously a game development, well, game platform and everything else.
I mean, to be fair, there were games on Zune and all of that stuff apart from browser on Zune before the iPod Touch.
True. Liv, do you have a Zune still? Do you use it still?
It's sitting somewhere in some drawer somewhere. I could use it. It still works. They're pretty durable bricks.
Mine's still going strong. I've got one of the old 30 gigabyte brown ones. Yeah, and it's still going strong. The battery's great. It's awesome.
Mine was the original one. I definitely didn't get the brown one, but it was good. But I actually have found there were problems with the software, but it was a very early iteration of said software, so I'm sure they've made huge improvements.
I thought the original one was the brown one.
There was a brown one and there was also a black one.
You get
one
in black. I got given it by...
I think the first one was actually a rebadged Toshiba Gigabeat in the very early days.
Yeah,
can you tell I used to review...
Which only came
audio
in brown.
probably. I can't remember. Wow. Anyway, we are going to continue our discussion about music as we move into our sort of news/feature this week. Duncan, you wrote a great feature that we published this morning called Could Music Service Topspin Fix the Artist-Fan Relationship, which focuses on a service that just went public at South by Southwest in the US. This was really, really interesting, particularly as someone who has music for sale out on music services. Why don't you tell me about this?
Yeah, this is... I'm actually really, really excited about this. This is a... I guess you could call it a direct-to-fan marketing and retail software platform, which just sounds dull as hell. But it's actually really, really cool if you make kind of any kind of music, but also if you kind of make other things like art or books, if you're an author or if you're a filmmaker or something like that. It works with all these things. And what it does is it gets together a whole wide range of kind of marketing-y things and puts them all in one place and lets you bundle them together. So
marketing-y things.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's break this down a little bit before you get into that. Let's pretend I'm an entire band and I have an album and I'm going out on tour. What is Topspin going to do for me and why should I use it?
Well, what Topspin does is it will let you upload and manage your music, your videos, any images you've got, so like album art, but also like posters and other fun stuff.
To a website.
To a website. Any digital assets can go up. You can then sell those and everything. It also lets you manage merchandise. It lets you manage fan clubs, VIP memberships, anything that you kind of want to build in terms of that. You can book shows through it. You can sell tickets to those shows through it. They've even got an iPhone app that you can use on the door of your shows to beat people in and make sure that they've paid. It kind of scans a little barcode on everybody's printed out tickets.
That's genius.
It's really, really cool. And but the really cool thing is that within that, you can bundle as many or as few of those things as you want together to turn them into kind of these packages that you can use to reward people at maybe different levels. So, for example, I don't know, you get people who are at the gold level of your fan club and they maybe get a free ticket to a gig every year or something like that.
So it's rewarding participation and support.
Yeah.
And if you support a band by buying two of their albums, you might get a free ticket or discount ticket to their show.
I mean, the really cool thing about it is how flexible it is and how they've built it so that it's you can use it across the globe without having to deal with local privacy issues, local taxes, local currencies, all of those things.
Now, I was going to say, these are all services that if you're a big band, that your label or your management might provide on your behalf.
And almost certainly do already. You'll have, 20 different people doing that. And what I think is really cool is that Topspin is cutting out a whole lot of middlemen out of this. And the music industry is rapidly shrinking in terms of middlemen very, very quickly at the moment. And this is, I feel like this is kind of going to accelerate that even faster.
Yeah, I mean, we've all got friends who've, you two are even in bands or make your own music, but I've got lots of friends who are either in bands who are constantly plugging their gigs or their music either through Facebook or through emails, and it's all a bit of a mishmash, and there's kind of no single point for all of this management of all of these different avenues and their engagement with their fans, and I think this provides it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely what they're trying to do, and for a couple of years it's been around. I think it started to show up in the press around the middle of 2008, and they've had this extended invite only beta period where they've got people as big as like Paul McCartney, Arcade Fire, Linkin Park, Beastie Boys, Trent Reznor loved it because he's very interested in doing new stuff with digital music.
Radiohead?
I don't think Radiohead have used it. No, I think they've always used their own sort of systems that they've built themselves to do a very similar thing.
Strikes me that it's very much an indie, something that's aimed at indie bands.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you've got like Beastie Boys, and you've got like Eminem has used it widely. I don't think there's anything necessarily about it that's particularly indie. You know, hip hop acts have fan clubs too.
But I mean, really, what this is in a way is kind of the next evolution of something like a cross between MySpace and Facebook for social networking, and kind of an e-commerce store that sells hoodies and t-shirts.
Kind of, yeah. And what the clever thing that they do is it lets you tie in all of that stuff that we were talking about before into your existing presences on these sites. So it hooks up to your Facebook profile, it hooks up to your MySpace, and it just pushes all the information out to those things without you having to do too much.
Presumably they can also then use that data in interesting ways.
There's a whole like massive amount of analytics involved as well. And it's all about changing the digital music industry. I think a lot of their philosophy has been very, very influenced by some of the thinkers who are, you know, really exploring the cutting edge of digital music. People like Mike Masnick from Tech Dirt with his Connect with Fans, Reason to Buy equals Money equation. Mm. And Tim O'Reilly, who once famously said that piracy is not the enemy, obscurity is. Mm.
But there are other things similar to this, aren't there, available? Other services?
It kind of is possible to glue stuff together from, you know, other things. You know, if you use, say, like Bandcamp and you added on SoundCloud and various other kind of services, you can stick things together in such a way that that you get a similar sort of thing for cheaper. And the price is the kind of interesting bit. They're charging, I think the cheapest offer they do is a $10 a month account, which is...
What do you get for that?
Sorry?
What do you get for $10 a month?
Well, pretty much all of the stuff I mentioned before. I think it's with... You have to have less than 2,000 people on your email list. Sorry. And once you've got 2,000 people, then it goes up to something like $50 a month.
Wait, sorry, and what's the email list? What's that?
Oh, I mean, it'll manage email lists for you and let you send out mail outs to people that sort of link through to all of the aforementioned things.
So almost like the more people you've got as a fan, the more that the service will cost per month?
Yeah,
I guess the more you'll be making.
But yeah, exactly. The more you'll be making, and they also sort of take a chunk of some of the things that you're doing. So when you're selling merchandise, and when you're selling physical product through it, and when you're selling MP3s, they'll take a little chunk of that.
So they provide the back end for the MP3 downloads, right?
Yeah, basically. I mean, they kind of set up a situation where it makes it really easy to be a band and have everything in one place, and they're charging more for it than their competitors are.
But it's kind of you're paying for the convenience. You're paying for being able to access all of these. You can do it while using other platforms, but it's easier to do it this way.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. And it's that being really, really easy to do it that's key. I mean, it's still, I think, the CEO of Topspin, Ian Rogers, said on his blog that their vision for Topspin is to be more like Photoshop than MS Paint. You know, it's something that you need to learn how to use over a period of time. It's not going to be you drop in there and you understand everything immediately.
So could this actually change then how the music industry operates? I mean, it's early days. It sounds great, but, you know, there have been a lot of other products that do very similar things, obviously, to this, but people are still signed to major labels. Personally, I would love to try this out if I was a band that was actually gigging and out there doing stuff. But obviously, I'd be skeptical because, well, I have to be. So, I mean, why might this not work? What are the downsides to this?
Well, I mean, the downsides, I guess, are the cost and the chunk that they take. There's also the fact that artists do need investment, you know, and traditionally that's come from a record company, but it can come from other places. And this doesn't necessarily solve that problem. Yeah, I mean, you can use fan funding, things like that, or there's a bunch of other ones as well. But artists will still need... You can't just sort of give an artist Topspin and say, right, off you go, you'll be the next Coldplay.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, you know, I have music that I write and record and mix and produce and finish and everything at home with all my home kit. And I can get that. I have got it on iTunes and Amazon and places like that. It's not taking me anything to do that because I already owned all the equipment and I know how to play and things. But for... If I wanted to actually get out there and gig and get proper CDs and proper mastering and proper mixing and everything else that comes with that, I'm going to need money. And I don't have any because I'm not gigging, which is a chicken
absolutely.
And egg problem that I would have if I was trying to do it professionally.
But I mean, I think
this
really,
doesn't solve.
But $10 a month, I mean, it's not a big investment.
And then it's not a bit, especially if it's split between four of you or whatever.
You're driving people to your gigs from the newsletters and you're driving people to buy your merchandise, which you don't have to spend any money on in up front because they will design it and print to order.
But it's not, though, is it? Because I'm paying $10 a month to basically have all the stuff I produce unified in one place, but they're not marketing my music for me, are they? And I still have to produce my own.
The idea is to make it much easier for you to market your own music. Yeah. And I mean, you know, if you just go on there and have a mailing, you know, give away an MP3 in exchange for an email address and then spam that mailing list, you're not really going to get very much out of it. It's more about letting people be creative in different ways and kind of inspiring people. And what I spoke to a chap called David Riley at a digital music consultancy called Good Lizard Media, and he made the point that I think is really crucial, that this is kind of about repairing the relationship between fans and artists that has really been kind of killed off over the last 10-15 years with the age of the CD. And
I have to disagree in a way. I actually think that it's been better than in many ways it has ever been, because it's now so easy to communicate directly to a fan. I mean, Twitter,
the point is that no major label artists are actually doing it. I mean, when was the last time you heard from Coldplay and thought, oh, I actually have a relationship with this band?
They put out
a record and then they spam everybody with it.
But this is where it's different and kind of why I think this is more for an indie band, because that does happen a lot of time with indie bands. The only reason that you might not get a message back from Lady Gaga or Justin Bieber or whatever is because they're too busy, you know, having their makeup done and things like that, you know, being on reality TV shows. Yeah. Whereas indie bands are far more likely, you know, they're standing outside the back of the club, signing albums. And, you know, I've had conversations with bands that I really like that I know that I would never have through exactly the same means, I guess, which is what you're saying, through social networks, if they were a massive band.
I think the point is that by putting all this stuff in one place, it kind of makes it easier for people like, you know, the people who've used it, like Eminem and Trent Reznor and Paul McCartney, to go out there, even though they've got vast fan bases, and be just that little bit more personal and that little bit more tailored to their fan base.
Very much doubt that they manage any of that stuff. I mean, it won't be them.
I mean, Trent Reznor certainly does. He does a lot of stuff on his own.
The one person on that list, I'd imagine, would actually have that direct engagement, but I really doubt the others would.
I think what this can really do is probably be something that the labels and bands who already have maybe a fairly established fan base, but they're doing things independently, to really consolidate all that and basically cut out a lot of the costs that are involved with contracting out other agencies and other companies to do things like merchandise handling and stuff like that.
It's kind of interesting that you mentioned the labels, because I spoke to David Emery from Beggars Group, which is one of the big independent labels, and he said that for us, they don't really offer anything that we can't do ourselves already. And it's quite expensive for us as a label, on the scale of a label, to do these things.
Because the popularity influences cost of the service.
Well, kind of. He said that it's a much nicer offering for a smaller artist who doesn't have the resources that a label does to draw upon. They don't have the access to the economies of scale for in terms of mailing lists and so on, and big, big like analytics products and stuff like that. What Topspin does is it gives smaller bands access to that infrastructure.
Okay, so basically it's independent bands that have already built and got a reasonable sized fan base, who are maybe unsigned and doing things themselves, and there are a lot of those sort of bands out there, mm-hmm. That left a label maybe because they felt they don't need it anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is basically for them. It's not for people necessarily like me, because I'm not producing t-shirts and I'm not touring. It's not for people necessarily like Coldplay, because as the guy from Beggars Group was saying,
David Emery,
it's expensive for them, and to be honest, they've probably already got their own in-house resources to do all that kind of stuff. So it's more like the guys who are small to medium sized and don't bother with a label anymore, which is what the internet has basically enabled bands to do that they can never do before.
It is very much about sort of taking the things that the internet does really, really well and making it very easy for bands to take advantage of that. And I think what the biggest effect that it's probably going to have is making it more and more likely for there to be a band that makes it big, properly big, without having a major label backing them, which hasn't properly happened yet and will happen sooner or later. It just hasn't happened yet. And I think that something like Topspin can accelerate that process.
So how do people actually get started if they want to use this?
It's pretty easy. You go to topspin.com and you hit the sign up button, and it asks you for a username, and you put that in, and then you can have a little kind of play around with all the stuff that they offer. But then to actually use any of it, to actually put tracks up for sale or to, you know, get a widget out or something like that, you have to sign up for at least the $10 a month price tag.
Give them the money.
Give them the money, exactly. I think what would be really nice is if they kind of had a freemium service that lets you maybe email 100 people or something like that.
So you can try it out if you're a small band for free.
So you can try it out, yeah.
I agree.
Or like a month's free trial or something like that.
Get on it, Topspin, because that was the last word. Because I'm calling the end of the show. Duncan, thank you very much. Tell people how they can email us, should they want to.
You should email podcast@wired.co.uk.
You can. And follow us on Facebook. It's getting richer and more exciting by the day, like Duncan's height. Which is
my height's getting richer.
Yes, it really is, because you have less hair now, so I can see more of your height. Which is facebook.com/UKWired, and you can follow us on Twitter @WiredUK. I am @NateLangson. Duncan is @DuncanGear. Liv, tell me what you are on Twitter.
Olivia_Solon.
And we will see you again next week.
Bye.